Thank you, Horace. What a great privilege it is to be back with you after two or three years. I want to tell you that we consider that Harv and Maydell and those who work with them are the living proof that we consider you folks here in the D.C. area the most important part of the Navigator ministry. If this were not true, why would we send our very best people here to be with you? So that's our thoughts about Harv and Maydell and those who work with them. I've been here for about an hour. It's been real great to visit with some of you again. It's a very pleasant experience in contrast to be among the intelligentsia again. Back at our headquarters, I was visiting a couple people who were doing some carpenter work the other day, and the fellow who was doing the nail pounding was discarding about every other nail, just throwing it aside. And so his supervisor came along and said, why are you throwing those nails away? And he said, well, the head is on the wrong end. So the supervisor picked it up, studied a little bit, and then he said, no, the head isn't on the wrong end. These are for the other side of the building. So you can see why it's such a refreshing experience to be here among you. This afternoon, we'd like to talk about four great thoughts from the book of Romans. Those of you who know me better than some of the rest know that I've been on sort of a kick for the last two or three years, and that is to do everything possible to see that every Christian I know is totally liberated, totally motivated, and totally fulfilled. I think that should be the normal Christian experience. So these four great thoughts from the book of Romans deal primarily with the first, to be totally free, totally liberated. Now, I make no apology for speaking from the book of Romans this afternoon. In studying a book on Romans recently, in the foreword there was a quotation from a Swiss theologian named Godet who said, every movement of revival in the history of the Christian church can be connected with the teachings of the book of Romans. That's significant if true. Every time God has brought a revival, it's been through a revival, through a study of the teachings of the book of Romans. Now, there's another reason that we want to do this study this afternoon. In the Navigators, we are very much achievement, project, and objective and performance-oriented. Is that true? Well, we spend a little time on being relationship-oriented. So this afternoon, I feel these are words of encouragement, more relationship-oriented than project-oriented. And that brings 1 Thessalonians 2:11 in balance, where we're told to exhort, and we do a little of that. To charge, and we do some of that. But also to encourage. So these are encouraging thoughts, I think. Great thoughts are condensed into great words. So the four great thoughts from Romans are condensed into four words. Now, regardless of what translation you have, The root word is the same. And I'm using the ancient version here this afternoon. So whatever your translation of the basic word is, the meaning is the same, because we're going back to the root word. So the first of these four words, which are condensations of great thoughts, is a word which appears in Romans chapter 3 and verse 25. Kind of a difficult word for some of us to pronounce, but I'll try to get it right as it is translated in my translation. We're told in this verse that Jesus Christ is the propitiation, whom God has set forth to be a propitiation through faith in His blood, to declare His righteousness for the remission of sins that are past through the forbearance of God. The word is propitiation. Now, what does it mean? The simplest way we can define it is it means the judgment seat has been turned into a mercy seat. Several months ago, in our home city of Colorado Springs, there was an unexplained death of a businessman. The coroner made his investigation and concluded that it was suicide. About 12 months later, that judge got a letter from a woman who had moved out of the state. She was writing from another state. And she said, "Now, I know everybody in Colorado Springs believes that this man's death was suicide. This is not true. I shot him. And I'm willing to come back to Colorado Springs and stand trial." So she came back, and the trial was held. At the conclusion of it, the judge took a very unusual role. He said, after hearing of the relationship that this man had with you and the abuse that has occurred, you've been punished enough. I'm going to sentence you to one day in jail and then suspend the sentence. And he said, I hope that the rest of your life is more pleasant than the past has been. The judge turned the judgment seat into a mercy seat. This is what propitiation means, that God has done this. Now let's approach it a different way. A few months ago, one of the young ladies who works in our office was getting ready to make an overseas trip. And to be a true tourist, she planned to take a lot of pictures. On her last noon hour, before she was to leave the next day, she went to a local department store and bought 12 rolls of film. She also bought a notebook, some other things. She piled the film up on the notebook, but every time she'd walk a little too fast, why, some of them would fall off. So she picked them up two or three times, and the last time stuck the top layer in the pocket of her purse. The store detective happened to be watching. She followed her through the check stand. As soon as she got outside, she apprehended her, sent for the police. So since it was the policy of this store to prosecute everybody without explanation, she was fingerprinted, and the day for the trial was set. None of us knew about this when it happened. She went ahead and made her overseas trip, and then came to see me one afternoon and told me the story and said that I'm going to trial at 9 o'clock in the morning for this. I think she kind of thought it would go away, but it didn't. So realizing that the prosecution would have a good lawyer, we got her the best lawyer we could, on short notice, and at 9 o'clock the next morning, I went down with her and the lawyer. We have a brand new judicial building in Colorado Springs, and it used to have just a small section, but a very elaborate building. So we went down the hall on the thick carpets with the glass doors separating the courtrooms, looking for Judge Campbell's courtroom. Well, pretty soon we found it. And right at the head of the docket was the people, versus, and then her name, and the violation. I'd been studying Romans, and I thought what a thrill it would be to her and to me if on the outside of Judge Campbell's courtroom we would read, "There's no charge pending against her name in this court." But that's what propitiation means. That if we were ever to visit any of the old bombed out courtrooms in heaven, turned into museums, we could find a sign on the door. "There's no charge pending against all of her names whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life in that court." Well, I'm sure you're interested to know what the outcome was. A trial lasted about 45 minutes. And then the judge said, "After having listened to all the evidence, I find the defendant not guilty." And so she walked out of the court free. I think in this case it wasn't a matter of mercy, because there was a degree of guilt. She had walked out even though her intention was not to do this. But you see the point. Propitiation means there's no charge pending against any Christian in the ex-courts of heaven. So immediately, this brings up the question, how about 2 Corinthians 5:10, which says we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ? Or Romans 14:10, "So then everyone shall give an account of himself to God." The word that's translated judgment, from what I understand in my studies, is the Greek word bema, B-E-M-A. A Christian scholar writing on this recently said, in Grecian athletic games, the forerunners to the Olympics, the president of the event sat on a raised platform called the reward seat, or the bema seat. As the contest ended, he rewarded the winner. Many of us watched the Olympics, or parts of them, on television a couple of years ago, and you remember how this practice still prevails. That right after the race, right after the swimming event, while the swimmer's water still dripping off, or the sprinter is so exhausted he can hardly walk, the winner receives his gold medal immediately. So the judgments that are talked about in 2 Corinthians 5 and Romans 14 are not judgments for sin. They are rewards for service. This is the meaning of 1 Corinthians 4:5, which says, "Then shall every man have praise of God." I do not know any Christian who is deliberately, or who is primarily motivated by the desire for reward. But reward is inescapable. In Matthew chapter 10, verses 39 through 42, Christ said it's impossible to even give another person a drink of cold water in the name of Christ and not be rewarded. I believe there are basically only two motivations which cause us to act. Love of self and love of Christ. And we can't even do such a small thing as get a cup of cold water in Christ's name and not be rewarded. So the first great word is the word propitiation, which means no charge against any Christian in any court that God has anything to do with. Now the second great word is found in Romans chapter 4, and this is the word impute or imputation. In Romans 4:6, we read, to him that works not, but believes on him that justifies the ungodly. No, verse 6, I was reading verse 5. Even as David also described the blessedness of the man unto whom God imputes righteousness without works. And in Romans 4:20-22, speaking about Abraham, and being fully persuaded that what God had promised he was able to perform, therefore it was imputed to him for righteousness. Now to explore this word, let me ask you a question. Is there anybody you know who maintains a personnel file with information about you? If you're in the military service, there's one. If you're a student, there's a file. I'm sure your employer has a file on you. The Internal Revenue Service has a file on you. And so does the Social Security Administration and probably the Credit Bureau also. Is there a personnel file in heaven? I think that there is. And I'd like to lead you on an imaginary journey into that file room. I think it looks pretty much like an ordinary room with file cabinets, except that every drawer is double width. So if you were to see the file clerk pull out a drawer, you would notice that on the left-hand side, all the files are pretty much what a conventional file folder looks like. But on the right-hand side, everyone is identical. You notice on the left-hand side, maybe in alphabetical order, some order like that. But on the right side, every one of them has the name Jesus Christ. So, if your curiosity is the way mine would be, if I were looking through the window in this room, I'd not say I'd like to come in. Could I examine my file? Well, as the attendant took it out of the drawer, I would notice that it was not nearly as thick as I'd suppose. And then the attendant pulls a kind of a sleight of hand trick, and I see him reach opposite my file, take out all the contents of the one marked Jesus Christ, slip it in mine, and then hand it to me. And I'd protest and say, now that's not my file. And the attendant would say, yes, that's your file. Impute has a threefold meaning. It means, first of all, that God imputed the sin of the human race to Adam. It means, secondly, God imputed the sin of Adam to Jesus Christ. And the third meaning is, God imputed the righteousness of Jesus Christ to every believer. And I want to suggest that what God has done, it's impossible for you and me to undo. I heard of a couple of schoolgirls that were having a little argument one day And all the evidence was on one side. But the girl that didn't have any evidence, she stuck to her point. And so finally the one who seemed to have all the evidence said, "Why do you persist in your point of view when I've got all the evidence on my side?" So the girl said, "My mother said that's the way it is. And when my mother says a thing is so, it's so whether it is or not." Well, when I heard that, I said, "That's God. In the creation there was darkness. He said, let there be light. And there was light. When God says a thing is so, it's so, whether we think it is or not." So, 1 Corinthians 1:30 assures us that God has imputed to us the righteousness of Jesus Christ. What do you admire the most about him? Make a list sometime. It's all in your file. God has imputed the righteousness of Jesus Christ to you. I attend a funeral occasionally, and it's always nice to hear what the one conducting a funeral has to say about the departed. So one of these days I'm going to write up the instructions for my funeral, and all I want the preacher to say is, "He had the righteousness of Jesus Christ." What more could any one of us want said? What a record you and I have, the righteousness of Jesus Christ. This is what impute means. Now the third great word in the book of Romans, and actually these other things we've talked about are parts of this, but it's the word justified or justification. In Romans 4:25, we read, "Jesus Christ was delivered for our offenses and was raised for our justification." 5:1, we're justified. 5:9, "Much more than being now justified by his blood, we shall be saved from wrath through him." The great doctrine of justification. What is it? Those of you who have studied the history of France know that a few generations ago there was a Jewish army captain who got into trouble. He was accused of treason. He was tried, found guilty, and sentenced to life imprisonment. Some of his friends and some of the people who were not his friends felt he hadn't had a fair trial. And they stirred up enough public reaction to cause the president of France, or the premier, whoever has the ability, to try to rectify the situation through offering him a pardon. So the papers were drawn up. Captain Dreyfus was presented with a pardon, only to refuse it. And he said, "I do not want a pardon. I want a new trial." So he was given a new trial, and as a result of the second trial, he was acquitted, which means he was found never to have been guilty in the first place. There's a lot of difference between a pardoned criminal and a justified citizen who is never guilty in the first place. So justification means we were never guilty in the first place. This is such a tremendous truth, and I've been looking for more and more illustrations, and I think I found a great one recently. Now this is going to tax you a little bit, particularly if you're a little sleepy and it's a little bit warm in here. We're making pretty good progress, don't you think? We're almost through 3 of the 4. you folks out there are partially aware that there's a great gulf fixed between us and you. As I look down it, I see Abraham and Lazarus. And I don't know who the other is down there. But actually, this whole platform is engineered. There's a track down here. And while it may not be discernible to you, this part here that I'm on is moving. And it's set so that it drops over the precipice at 5 o'clock. But I'm not going to take a chance. I'm not going to get that close to the edge. Well, I said I've been looking for an illustration. And I think I found it. And this will tax you just a little bit to follow. Over in 2 Kings, chapter 6, and verse 1, a little statement thrown in here with two or three figures in it. I said 2 Kings, I mean 1 Kings, 6:1. And just to make sure we're following, I'm going to ask you a question or two back and ask you to give me the answer back here at the platform as I ask it. I'll read the verse first, then I'll ask you the questions, and I'd like to have your response, okay? In my translation, it says, it came to pass in the 480th year. Now, I want to underline that. After the children of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, then the last sentence, he began to build the house of the Lord. Solomon began to construct the temple at a certain point in history. Now, he gave two reference points as to when he started to do this. And that's what I want to know. What are the two points of reference? What was the first one? Point of reference? Now, I hope the sound comes out there better than it comes back up here. The point of reference was, what did he start to do? He started to build the temple. And then that's inserted in two points of reference. I think I'm mixing you up more than I'm helping you here. But what was the first point of reference he started out with? The event. The children of Israel coming out of Israel, the Exodus. And what was the fourth point? The fourth year that Solomon was king. And the period in between was how long? 480 years. Now we have a problem or two. And if you turn over to Acts 13, maybe we can figure this out. So do a little addition here with me, if you will. How long were they in the wilderness? 40 years. And after they got out, verse 20 of Acts 13 says, and after that, he gave unto them judges for about the space of 450 years. So how long were they in the wilderness? 450. And then there were judges, how long? 450. How much does that come to? 490. We're already over the limit. How long was it from the Exodus to the fourth year of Solomon? 480. We're already up to 490. After that, he gave them Saul. How long did Saul reign? 40 years. Who was Saul followed by? David for 40 years. And then we go into the fourth year of Solomon. So we're already over the limit. And we got another 84 years. Now, we didn't even include the period of Joshua's conquests that were about 20 years between the wilderness and the judges. Now, I know the different translations figure this out in different ways, but there's no way that you can make it come out 480 years. We have a problem. How do we solve the problem? Well, I was reading the other day, I think it's the 81st Psalm. If it isn't, I'll give you another verse on it. The psalm writer said that God has blotted out all their iniquities, he said. I didn't look that up and I missed it. But the main one I wanted anyway was Hebrews 10:17, where God said, their sins and iniquities will I remember no more. Do you think it's possible for God to blot something out of his memory? Do you? If he's able to blot it out of his memory, can it stand in history? Somebody told me the other day, there's some things God can't do. And one of them is that he can't change the past. That he can't rewrite history. But I think we've got an illustration here this afternoon. God did rewrite history. The historian said, it's 514 years from the Exodus to the fourth year of Solomon. One person who was exercised about this problem added up all the disobediences of the people of God from the Exodus to the fourth year of Solomon. You know what he came up with? 114 years. He subtracted the 114 years from 514. What did he get? 480. The historian said it was 514 years. The Holy Spirit said it's 480 years. Don't try to make any more out of it. What does this mean? Justification means that God has blotted out of his memory every instant we've been disobedient and placed it under the blood. And he's closed that gap in history. And God said that never existed. That's what justification means. We are more than pardoned. We are justified. Now, I think we should throw in parentheses here a little something before we come to the fourth and final word. I heard about a traveler one day who stopped into a church on the road. He happened to be driving by at 11 in the morning, went in. He'd never been in that denomination before, happened to be Episcopalian. But after that, whenever anybody asked him what his church membership was, he said he was Episcopalian. They thought it was kind of strange that he could just go in that for 1 hour on Sunday morning and then become an Episcopalian. They said, why are you an Episcopalian? He said, well, while I was in there, I read on their order of worship that man sins daily in word, deed, and thought. And he said, now if that's what they believe, that's what I believe. Because that's me. It describes me. I sin daily in word, thought, and deed. In spite of all these great things that we've talked about, we still sin. We're going to talk more about that in a minute. What happens? John chapter 13, I think, describes what we need to reflect on for a minute. You remember this was Christ's last night on earth. And he did a strange thing. He asked for a towel, a basin of water, and he started to do that which was a servant's role. Throughout the Orient today, and much of the Middle East, instead of wearing Western shoes the way most of us wear, they have what I heard a sailor once describe as anti-backing down shoes. You know, they just held on between your a great toe and the one next to it. You can go forward, but don't try to go backwards in them. And, of course, as you walk around where there's not sidewalks and roads in that, so your feet not only get hot and dusty, but you occasionally get a rock underneath. So even to take a short journey from one home to the other in the Middle East, your feet would probably get hot and dusty and some rocks underneath the sandals to cause irritation. So when the servant met you at the door, and instead of taking your hat and coat, first thing you do, remove your sandals, bathe your feet, take a towel, wipe them off, go on inside. Something the servant did. On this last night on earth, Christ asked for the basin, you remember, and started to do this. Among those, of course, that was going to experience this was Peter. I know you've had Jim Peterson with you in the area here. He's the first one I ever heard use this expression. He called him Peter the Lip. So, Peter the Lip. In verse 6, then came he to Simon Peter, and Peter said unto him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And Jesus said, verse 7, what I'm about to do you don't know now, but you'll know hereafter. And Peter the Lip said, you'll never wash my feet. These other knuckleheads may let you do it to them, but not to me. I'm too humble to allow that to happen. And Jesus answered him, verse 8, if I wash thee not, you have no part in me. So Peter Lip said, well, if washing my feet gives me a part with you, wash me all over. Give me a whole bath. Verse 10, Jesus said to him, he that is washed needs not except to wash his feet, but is clean every whit, and you're clean, but not all. First time I was in Japan, I was out in the edge of a little city there, and I just couldn't reconcile why I saw so many Japanese ladies walking on the sidewalk that had their hair in curlers and a towel around their neck. You know, just 9 out of 10. And then I found out at that period in Japan's history, the public bathhouse was very much in use. They don't have a bath in every house. They have one on the block, one for every block. And the Japanese, some of them, bathe 3 times a day. So they make a lot of trips between home and the bathhouse. So they go there, take a bath. When they come home, after having worn their Japanese sandals, their feet are a little bit dirty again. So they have to wash their feet before they go in the house. So Christ told Peter, now, Peter, you have all been regenerated except one. You don't need to be regenerated all over again, just your feet. Christ was saying that which was to come out later in the Bible, I think. Once you've been born again and washed in the blood of Christ, you never need to have this happen again. But through sin, we are defiled daily. And this is a personal, individual matter. One great theologian said, you sin them one at a time, you've got to confess them one at a time. So, whether it is regeneration, or whether it is the confession of sin, God applies these great truths we've talked about of propitiation and of imputation and of justification. Now, I want to conclude with the fourth word, And I think this is very practical. In Romans 6:11, there's a verse that has confused more Christians, it seems to me, than it has helped. So we'd like to clarify that, if we can this afternoon. Now the reason for the confusion is only reading the first half, which says, "Reckon yourselves also to be dead indeed unto sin." And a lot of us have tried that. Reckon is an accounting term. So we go around and say that I'm dead to sin. That's what the Bible says. But my actions prove that I'm not. To illustrate this, I want to go over to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 41. Christ was telling the civilians how to witness to the military. He was interested in both. Later on, the military got so turned on about the gospel that they were the chief instrument in witnessing to civilians. But at this point in history, it was the civilians, the soldiers. So, Christ explained how they could do this. There was a practice in that day that a Roman soldier carried his own equipment. Now, I'm sure there's some of you fellows here in the army that will dispute this, but it seems to me that about every soldier today has either a Jeep or a pickup or a truck. You know, you don't see them walking much when they move. But this day, a soldier moved on foot. And he had to carry everything that he had with him. I don't know how much his pack weighed, probably 60 or 70 pounds. The Roman government recognized that this was sort of a hardship. So it was Roman law that any soldier could commandeer any civilian and require him to carry his pack to the next milestone. If the civilian refused, he could be prosecuted under the law. But if when the soldier came to the milestone and he looked around, there was no other civilian, and he said, "You've got to carry this to the next milestone," and the soldier made him unwillingly carry it a second mile, then the soldier could be court-martialed. So Christ, telling the civilians how to minister to the soldier, he said, "You've never seen a civilian that when he got that milestone didn't hand it back to the soldier, and if the soldier didn't take it, he'd throw it on the ground." He said, "Now, next time, you're carrying a soldier's pack, and you come to the milestone, and there's nobody else there, you carry it on to the next milestone." And that will represent such a change in attitude that you'll be able to witness to him all that second mile. Or he said, "Whoever shall compel you to go a mile, go with him twice." Now to illustrate this truth, I'd like you to take a little imaginary journey. And you're a civilian. In the time of history, these things were in effect. And you work about a mile from your apartment. And in the same complex, there is quartered a Roman soldier. And he leaves about the same time you do every morning. Apparently he doesn't know whether he's going to get back or not because he always takes his pack with him. So you show up the milestone about the same time. So he hands you the pack. Now I've already made one mistake in my story. And that is that you and the soldier both work 2 miles from home. So you go down the road for a mile, you come to the second milestone, and he looks around, and he said, "Well, I don't see anybody else here. How about carrying it to the next milestone?" And you say, "I've been reading in the law, and the law says that I don't have to. And because the law says I don't have to, and I'm not going to do it. So the soldier, who happens to be about twice as big as you are and twice as well armed, rolls up his sleeve a little bit and looks you over, and he said, "I say that you're going to carry it another mile." And you say that the law says I don't have to. He says, "Well, you've always done it, and you're not going to stop now." So, through badgering and threatening and saber rattling, now tell me the truth. What would you do in this circumstance? Tell me, what would you do? You've already pled the law, and that didn't do any good. What would you do? Won't somebody be honest? Carry another mile. Even though the law said you didn't have to. I believe the Scripture teaches that we are dead to the obligation to sin. But we are not dead to the inclination to sin. So the last part of Romans 6:11 says, "Reckon you also yourselves to be dead indeed unto sin, but alive unto God through Jesus Christ, our Lord." He doesn't say reckon yourself to be dead unto sin without saying reckon yourself to be alive unto God through Jesus Christ. So you find out how to solve the problem. And you notice that right opposite that first milestone, there's a little shopping center. So on your day off, you go around and make some mental notes about all the different people that are in the shopping center. And you notice there's a courtroom, and there's a judge. And you notice there's a police booth. And you notice there's a military post with some senior officers stationed there. And you all notice that so notice there's a lawyer in the complex. And as you visit around, you find out that you have several friends that work there. And some of them are muscle men. So during the week, an idea generates. And you write a letter to your five muscle men friends, to the lawyer, the judge, the policeman, and the general that are stationed there, and say, "I've got a very urgent matter. And so, at Monday morning, will you please meet me 8 o'clock at the milestone in front of this little complex?" Now, this milestone's halfway from where you work, you see. A mile from home, a mile in between for the second mile. So, they all agree to. So, Monday morning at 8 o'clock, you and the soldier show up as usual. He looks around, doesn't think these people are likely prospects, I guess. And he says, "Well, you can't break the habit now. You've got to carry it the second mile." So you give your friends the high sign. The judge comes out, lawyer comes out, policeman, the general, and the five muscle men. So you say to the lawyer, "Now what does the law say?" It says you don't have to do it. You say to the judge, "Has this law ever been tested in court?" He said, "Yes, and it's been upheld every time. You don't have to do it." You turn to the policeman and say, "What's your involvement in this?" "Well, my job is to enforce the law." And you say to the general, "What's the Army's position on this?" He says, "Well, the Army wrote the regulation, so they want to carry it out." And just in case there's any doubt, you call on the five muscle man friends that you've got. Say, "How do you feel about it?" They say, "We're prepared to back you up." Now, in the face of all the resources you've mobilized, what do you think the soldier's going to do with his demand? What do you think? Think he'll give up at that point? The Scripture says the secret to reckoning ourselves dead is to reckon ourselves alive unto God through Jesus Christ, being aware of all the resources. Yes, we have the inclination to sin, but we do not have the obligation to sin. You know, I think that almost every sin I commit, if not all of them, are because I forget about the resources that are right there. And I don't call on the resources. I give in to the threatening and the browbeating. You've always done it. Can't change now. And I'm ruled by the inclination rather than freed from the obligation. One day, one of D.L. Moody's converts was walking past a saloon where he used to do a lot of drinking. And the barkeeper said, "I'm going to get him back." So he went out and dumped a glass of whiskey on the sidewalk, because he knew right in front of the door that when this ex-alcoholic came over and breathed the fumes, that he just couldn't go ask him, and he'd have to turn in the saloon and get another drink. But to the saloon peeper's surprise, the new Christian walked right on down the sidewalk. So he ran out, and he called him by name. He said, "You can't go past here without coming in and taking a drink." And the convert says, "No, I can't." But he said, "Jesus and I can. We can go right on." So they went right on. Not reckoning ourselves dead indeed unto sin, without reckoning that we are dead, that we are alive unto God. So these are our four great words. They're designed to be encouraging and to be liberating and to make us in balance with relationship-oriented as well as achievement-oriented. First time I gave this message on these thoughts, a friend of mine who's very self-righteous came up. He said, "I would be afraid to preach that kind of a message and that kind of teaching. I'd be afraid to." And I said, he said, "People lose their motivation." I said, "The book of Romans was written by the most highly motivated man in history, Christian in history, the Apostle Paul. These things motivated him. And the reason that he had a burning desire to get to Rome was because God had given him the new revelation of these truths, and he couldn't wait to get down there and share them. And we're glad that he couldn't, because he took time to write the book of Romans. One great scholar has said, besides what I said, every movement of revival in history of the Christian church can be connected with the book of Romans. He says that justification, the knowledge of justification, inevitably leads to a moral and righteous life. So it's too good to be true, almost, isn't it? I believe this is what the Bible teaches. I'm not afraid to teach it, because the knowledge of these truths, as I said, were motivating to the most highly motivated Christian in history. I trust as a result of our reflection on them that the book of Romans can become more alive as you think about these four great words. And what were they? What was the first one? Propitiation. The second one? Imputation. The third one? Justification. And I didn't emphasize the fourth one, but it's there in Romans 6:11. What is it? Reckon. There's a lot more great thoughts and great words in the book of Romans. It's been a real privilege to be with you this afternoon in this low-profile teaching session. I'll leave the preaching up to your dynamic leaders.